and welcome to another episode of The Capitol Record. I am David Bonson, your host of Capitol Record, coming to you each and every Thursday with some desperate hope of advancing the cause of a free and virtuous society, doing what we can to defend free enterprise and the very concept of robust financial markets. And to that aim, I have a guest today who I believe is really going to interest you a lot. There is a number of dimensions that we may have on this podcast. We have had academics, we have had policymakers, we've had thought leaders, we've had plenty of portfolio managers, we've had economists, and Stephen Moran is going to scratch all of those itches. He is a PhD from Harvard. In economics, he was a portfolio manager before leaving Wall Street to go to the Treasury Department. He worked as a policymaker in the Treasury Department throughout the COVID moment, serving in the Trump administration, and then now has returned back to Wall Street and is currently a lead portfolio manager at Amber Wave. So you have a really holistic knowledge and experience in all aspects of policy, markets, the economy, and more. And we're going to touch on all these things as I welcome first-time guest to Capitol Record, Stephen Moran. So with all of that said, allow me to welcome a first-time guest to Capitol Record, someone I've been very excited to have on for this conversation. Welcome to National Review's Capitol Record, Steve.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me. It's a treat to see you, and a treat to be here with all the listeners.
So why don't we start with letting you kind of tell listeners a little bit about yourself, both your background and what you're doing now. I know there's some things that will be of interest in the last few years, in particular, but probably where we're going in the next few years will be fun as well. So kick us off a little with what you've been up to.
Sure. I guess my background is as someone who has training as an economist, you know, sort of was trained as a policy economist at Harvard, and then went right into markets and, you know, immediately had my nose bloodied by the fact that markets in the real world don't work the way that academic economists tell you that they should all the time. And so immediately had to reconcile, you know, the economic training that I had with the harsh realities of the market and the world that we really live in. Worked in markets for about a decade, you know, had a stint at Fidelity, worked as a portfolio manager at a Druckenmiller-backed fund, and then found myself in 2020 with the opportunity to join the U.S. Treasury Department and help out with the implementation of the CARES Act, help out with the U.S. government's fiscal and financial response to the pandemic recession, as well as thinking about the economy, thinking about future policies and what we should or shouldn't do, and really have the opportunity to have a bit of a front row seat in the economic crisis that we all experienced a couple years ago.
So you mentioned that being a Harvard-educated economist didn't necessarily train you for some of the realities of markets, but I wonder if some of your time in the realities of markets helped train you for your time as a policymaker in Washington.
Oh, absolutely. You know, in markets, so the big difference is that in academia, you know, the old joke that academia makes progress one funeral at a time isn't quite true, but there is a kernel of truth to it in the sense that people can have wrong ideas and continue those wrong ideas their entire careers because of the tenure system. And that works, and it works quite well for people. In markets, if you're wrong, you're very quickly, very quickly carried out, very quickly out of business, very quickly unemployed. So it's very, very different, and sort of having that hard-nosed experience about what really matters in the economy really, I think was helpful in thinking about how we should respond to the crisis.
Well, it seems that perhaps a less harsh application of the principle you're talking about of markets that still makes the same point you're making about academia is maybe sometimes being wrong in markets doesn't mean you're carried out. But it does mean you might have to pivot, where you can be wrong and have to make an adjustment if what you were wrong about wasn't fatal. It still requires a course correction. And it doesn't seem that academia is forced to adjust to the realities of fallibility very often.
Absolutely. You know, and the difference is exactly what you said, in that you can persist in being wrong in academia and meanwhile continue, you know, sort of making policy recommendations that are, you know, either helpful or not helpful. But in the real world, if you persist in being wrong, you know, you'll find yourself, in bad shape pretty soon.
And so before we kind of get into the time at Washington Treasury, and if you don't mind, I'd love to talk a little bit about PPP and some of that. But what were some of the things as you entered life in markets? You mentioned being in the buy side as a portfolio manager. What were some of the things that you found to be different in the reality of markets versus maybe what some of the expectation was coming out as an academic?
Sure. So, I mean, I would say that the most obvious thing is the behavioral element of how markets operate, and the fact that some markets are very forward looking, right, and can look, you know, years ahead, and other markets can only look a few weeks ahead. And the behavioral interplay with how the one market affects the other is really something that active managers exploit in terms of generating returns, that from at least the state of academia when I was finishing my doctorate, you know, sort of people thought that markets were generally efficient and that all information was, you know, pretty much immediately capitalized into all markets.
And is that something that is still persistent at the Ivy League? I would think Chicago versus Ivy would be in a little tension on this point.
You know, they always have been, and I'm a little bit removed from the academic debate these days. But for sure, in markets, you have to immediately put your finger on what's driving the change in supply and what's driving the change in demand for a particular asset to think about what the price is going to be doing.
And so when the phone rang, this is after the COVID emergency moment had sort of begun, that you were summoned to Washington?
Yeah, you know, I joined Treasury the first week of April of 2020. So the crisis was in full swing. The CARES Act had just been passed and signed by President Trump, and everyone was in the process of setting up all the facilities to get aid into the economy.
And so in that moment, and I know we have a lot of listeners that are fascinated by this. You can imagine too, by the way, it is sort of the nature of the beast. There's people that are really appreciative of the work that was done in the moment of CARES Act, particularly in the PPP facility, the intentions that went from the Trump administration down to particularly Treasury. I myself am very close with Larry Kudlow at NEC. I think very fondly of Secretary Mnuchin. And so you get into that PPP moment, and of course, you know, there's a lot of criticism now today. Do you think that most of the criticism should be targeted at some of the execution and sort of unfortunate reality of certain things, but not the intention? Or do you think there were flaws in the intention? I guess maybe just give us your view as an insider of what you think was done well and maybe could have done better in the moment of PPP.
Yeah. So when it comes to PPP, to the Paycheck Protection Program, you know, we have to keep in mind that when the CARES Act was written and then PPP was stood up, the economy was just free falling, and it left, you know, it made 2008 and the financial crisis, you know, look slow by comparison, because the speed with which everything instantaneously shut down. This wasn't a case of gradually rolling financial contagion. And the goal of CARES and the goal of the program was basically to put the economy on life support, because the prevailing view in the public health circles at the time was 2 weeks to flatten the curve. right? And okay, so maybe not 2 weeks, maybe 2 months, 2.5 months, as the original CARES Act laid out for PPP. But you know, there was the idea that we were gonna, you know, that we were gonna shut down for some period of time and then reopen on the other side of it, right? So the goal was really to get money out the door into the economy as quickly as possible in order to prevent waves of small business closures. Because once a small business closes, there's all sorts of capital that disappears. There's customer relationships, there's supplier relationships, there's contractor relationships, there's regulatory relationships that could take years to establish, right? And once those business closes, rebooting that up, finding workers again, takes a really long time, and that could cause the recovery to be very slow. But by keeping things on ice, by doing PPP, the goal was to be able to turn the light switch off and then turn the light switch back on. And that's why we had such a strong recovery in June and July of 2020, when all economists across the board, you know, every surveyed economist expected millions more job losses, and we actually started adding jobs back to the economy in a really strong way. So when it comes to thinking about problems with PPP in retrospect, you know, there were loans that didn't need to be made. But had we taken more time, had they taken more time in writing the CARES Act, taken, you know, several more weeks or several more months hammering out details and writing better legislation, and then had we taken several more weeks or several more months in setting up the implementation facilities in order to prevent some loans that didn't need to be made from being made, you would have really slowed down the flow of money from the government into the economy. And that would have allowed all sorts of bankruptcies that would have really, that would have, first of all, made the recession way, way, way worse than it was, but also really, really delayed the recovery from the recession. And this has been a super fast recovery from the 2020 recession, particularly in contrast to the recovery from 2008, 2009. And things would have looked a lot, you know, much, much, much worse had we delayed.
I think a lot of times when I hear people critical of the moment and the aftermath, it does seem, it's understandable to me, and yet it seems that the criticism in hindsight is more at the public health response than the economic team who was having to respond to what the public health response was, right? So in other words, someone may say, they shouldn't have shut down the economy for so long, or more particularly, and this happens to be my view, whatever was done in March, April, May of 2020 is one thing, and we can all Monday morning quarterback it, and I'll do plenty of that. I have my opinions, but businesses still being forced closed down in March of 2021. Or January of 2022, you know, it was the incredible extension of restrictions that I think, first of all, negated a lot of the economic benefit that was done out of PPP. It was intended for certain businesses to get a lifeline of 6 to 8 weeks, and then hotels and restaurants in some big cities were forced down for a year and a half. Then that kind of threw off a lot of the calculus. But it just I think there's a category confusion from some critics sometimes. All of it's fair game, but intellectually, I think it's more honest to look at what Treasury was having to do in the context of responding to the public health criteria. The public health response is a whole separate category worthy of its own analysis. Do you think that's a fair distinction?
Yeah, I really do think that's a fair distinction, and I think that we really, you know, have to be forgiving both of the fact that, you know, sort of in hindsight, you could you know, in unlimited time, you could design a much, much, you know, sort of more targeted program. But I think we have to be forgiving both of Congress and of you know, ourselves at Treasury, because there was fog of war and there was urgency and there was the need to get the dollars out immediately. Now, what's less forgivable is exactly what you just said, that later on, there wasn't the fog of war and there wasn't the same sense of urgency, right? In March, April of 2020, it was, you know, wow, everything is falling apart. Get the dollars out as soon as possible. It doesn't matter how, right? By the time you get to, you know, sort of the next economic support package that was passed in December, you know, and then signed by President Trump around the turn of the year, and then by the time you get to the American Recovery Plan, you know, that the Biden administration enacted, you know, when you get to continued business closures, there was no more fog of war. We knew exactly what was going on in the economy. We had a much better sense of what was going on. And all of those excesses, you know, there you can assign a little bit of blame.
Fair enough. That makes sense. Well, so when did you end up leaving Treasury? When was your work done there? And tell us a little bit about what you're doing now.
Sure. You know, I left Treasury with the rest of my colleagues, with the with the change in management to the Treasury Department as Secretary Mnuchin left and Secretary Yellen came in.
So the catalyst to the departure was not merely some milestone with COVID and PPP. It was particularly the election and the changeover of administration.
Yeah, it was the change in administration. She's in, you know, she's entitled to her own staff, just as every Treasury Secretary is.
Yep.
Now I'm working with some former colleagues from Treasury, and we're working on investing based on sort of mega trends in the macro economy and the global macro outlook.
And so when you think about the added chain of events in your life and career. We talked about academia, into markets, into government. Now, back into markets, was the time in government another additional learning experience as you come back into the really impactful space of being a market actor? Are you better off for that time in government?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've seen a little bit behind the curtain of how the sausage gets made, you know, how policy gets made, and the different political forces that are driving it. I came into it a little bit cynical about policy, but I saw some things there that made me, a little bit even more. For example, we were just talking a moment ago that when the economy really needed more stimulus, the economy really needed stimulus in March, April, May of 2020, and then maybe some more over the summer and early fall. But, sort of the next COVID relief package didn't get seriously entertained until the day after the election, right? So what magically changed between, October of 2020 and November 15th of 2020 was just that the political calendar had changed despite the needs of the American people. So, if anything, it made me, just a hair more cynical about how policy gets made. But in
that case, I'm curious, would you have been less cynical if the sort of sentiment was stimulus wasn't needed before the election or after? And maybe that was wrong, but it was consistent pre and post, or sentiment was needed before and after stimulus before and after. In other words, was your cynicism based on how the election changed the viewpoint versus a potential just mere disagreement over the propriety of stimulus to begin with?
It's based over the fact that that people's views over what the economy needed really could change depending on which team it helped or hurt. Right. Yeah. And it was very obvious in July and August that, we should do more in terms of economic support. Right. And we couldn't until November because of the political calendar. Yeah. And so the idea that there were people who would have supported, more support had there not been an election, right, suddenly changed their views just because the political calendar changed.
Yeah, I hear you. And I share that frustration. I share it, by the way, regardless of which party is doing it, right? Having a political calculus around what one believes economically. The piece I guess I'm suggesting is someone could have been wrong in believing that stimulus was not needed before the election. But I would be more impressed if they maintained that belief after as well. In other words, they were at least consistent that their view was driven by some economic viewpoint that was not driven by a political calculus. And I would prefer they be wrongly consistent than the political inconsistency and interference that you're referring to driving that particular decision.
Oh, absolutely. But that's the world we live in. That's Washington.
Well, let me ask you this. Before we get into the macro environment, I think it's helpful when I have an economist with an academic in markets and governmental background to ask this question. But because the context we've been talking about this question in so far has been the emergency moment of COVID, I want to ask you as much as possible to pretend that never happened. Hmm. When you talk about the economy needing support, and you're referring to governmental support, the economy needing stimulus, if we were not talking about the COVID moment, a governmental lockdown, an annualized quarterly drop of 30% in GDP, if we were just talking about the run-of-the-mill business cycle, where there are moments of contraction, including recessionary ones, and there are moments of expansion, just at a philosophical level, Steve, do you believe that, generally speaking, a free economy should be the recipient of support from a governmental entity?
Generally speaking, I do believe that there is a role for countercyclical policy, but I do think we've maybe seen some significant exaggeration of what that role should be. And I think in particular, so I would say two further things. One, you know, fiscal policy for stabilization purposes really should be extremely infrequent, right? It really should be when you're in the middle of a, you know, once in many decades crisis, as it was in 2020. That's not what you use for a garden variety recession, right? For a garden variety recession, you use monetary policy. Now, that said, as far as monetary policy goes, I know you had Judy Shelton on recently, and you know, I do agree with you guys that, you know, monetary policy has become overburdened and trying to do too much. And I think I would push it a little bit further and say, not only has it been trying to do too much, but economists in general and policymakers too have, you know, erred in thinking that they know too much, and if they know more than they really possibly could know. And if you look at the Fed's mandate, that, you know, we sort of talk a lot about the dual mandate, but it's really a triple mandate. It's maximum employment, you know, stable prices and stable long-term interest rates for the US Treasury Department. And when you think about stable prices, right, you know, the Fed interprets that as 2% inflation, right? And, you know, particular, you know, personal consumption expenditure inflation as they interpret it. But when you think about 2% inflation, you know, I think it's insane to believe that economists know where, you know, scare quote true inflation is. All economists know is where measured inflation is, right? They know where the BLS says CPI is, and then they know where the BEA takes BLS's CPI number and translate that into a PCE inflation number. Right. So economists know measured inflation. We don't really know, quote, true inflation, and nobody ever will. And one of my favorite examples when thinking about the big difference is if you ever, you know, you go to a computer and you go to the BLS website, or you know, sort of go to Bloomberg or wherever, and you type in the CPI series for televisions, you'll see that televisions are equal to 100 in the base year 1982, and they're equal to, like, you know, 3 or 4 cents now. So televisions have gone down in price by 97% since 1982. They cost pennies on the dollar, and they're basically free. Why is that? That's because of what economists call hedonic adjustments, which basically means adjustments for improvements in quality, right? And so if the price of a good stays the same and the quality goes up, the quality adjusted price has gone down, because you've gotten more quality adjusted good for the same number of dollars, right? So it is true that TVs have been getting better and better for decades. And it is true that if you tried to sell a 1982 TV, you probably would get pennies on the dollar for it. You wouldn't get the price, you know, you wouldn't get the real price that you paid in 1982 for it. You get pennies on the dollar for it. So in that sense, that's accurate. But if you go to anybody on the street and say, don't you love the fact that TVs are free? Don't you love the fact that TVs cost only a penny? Don't you love the fact that you could have as many TVs as you want because they cost you nothing? I think that, you know, they'd either smack you or they'd laugh you out of the room. You know, so there's very little correspondence from inflation as it gets recorded in this series to inflation as it's lived by ordinary people. And, you know, we can sort of go through the housing, you know, the distortions in how they measure housing. That's massive also. And that's a much, much, much bigger weight in the CPI than something like TVs is. But I think the TVs example is just so egregious as illustrating the problems in measuring inflation that it strikes me as completely insane to map price stability into, you know, sort of 2% inflation and then really reacting strongly to 1.8 or 2.2%, right? The idea that the measurement error is less than 20 or 30 basis points of, quote, true inflation strikes me as just completely nuts. And so the idea that the Fed was going to change its entire monetary policy framework by introducing this flexible average inflation targeting, as it did in 2020, because it had undershot its target for some, it had undershot its measured inflation target for so many years, you know, PC inflation running 1.6, 1.8% for so many years before, you know, before COVID. And so they changed their target, their framework to this flexible average inflation targeting, which meant that they were going to be necessarily behind the curve because they wanted to catch up. Right. So the idea that they would take a massive overhaul to monetary policy and how it's conducted and force themselves to ignore multiple percentage points increases in measured CPI because of misses of 20, 30 basis points for the previous decade just struck me as completely nuts, frankly, because I think that it's very difficult to know what true inflation is. And when people take huge actions in response to missing the target by 20, 30 basis points, it just strikes me as really the wrong approach to monetary policy.
And so what you're getting at, it sounds to me, is, you know, back to my question about whether or not interventions and stimulus are needed, and you're pointing out that there is an imperfection of knowledge from both those who would be daring to realm into fiscal interventions and those who would be daring to realm into monetary interventions, and that the present framework that they use to do so is subject to very, very fallible data that is being interpreted in very fallible ways. That distinction between measured and true inflation is incredibly important. But why not conclude from that, that therefore this knowledge problem, which is sort of a Hayekian notion, and the practical problem, which is something that we have the ability to comment on because of your experience and expertise academically, governmentally, in markets, all realms of your background speak to this. Why not conclude that any interventions should be safe but rare? I won't get into the other context that expression is often used. Why not make interventions highly rare as opposed to a sort of default assumption that monetary policy can help be an arbiter of the business cycle?
So I think that they should be rarer than they are. As I was saying a moment ago, you know, I don't think that there's a substantive difference between 1.8% inflation and 2.2% inflation. I don't view that. And for most of the last, you know, 10, 15 years, that's what we've been arguing over for most of them. Right. I don't view that as a substantive difference, and I don't view that as meriting a policy response. I do think there's a big difference between, let's say, 1% inflation and 5 or 6% inflation.
Sure.
Right. And so I think it's, you know, and that comes from sort of surveys of inflation. It comes from talking to ordinary people about how they experience inflation in the economy. It comes from markets. And so I do think that there's a role for responding to what I would describe as obvious misses of the inflation target.
But you're yeah. using the inflation side, the price stability portion of the mandate. I think until more recently, most monetary policy was being done around the other side of the mandate, which I think is more subject to error in intervention and a pendulum swing effect, meaning responding to economic weakness. So let's stimulate through low rates to drive employment. And it seems to me to have built a dependency that so we want 3% unemployment, and yet the tool that has been used since Greenspan to do that, highly accommodative monetary policy, seems to me to have been baked in the cake. The presumption now, we are literally talking as if cats and dogs are falling from the sky because of a 2.5% Fed funds rate, maybe about to be a 3% or 2.75% Fed funds rate. Is the idea that the Fed can create unemployment, or when we have cyclical times of higher unemployment, that a monetary response is warranted? Are you comfortable with that belief?
I am, but I think that there's limits to what the Fed can achieve with that, and there are adverse consequences in the form of effects in capital markets. And the reason why we're reacting that it's raining cats and dogs is not because the what's happened at the front end of the yield curve, because very few, you know, very few people are really sort of borrowing in the Fed fund in the Fed funds rate like that. It's what's happening to asset prices, right? And so you've had enormous volatility in the stock market. You've had huge moves higher in mortgage rates, right? So that's really affected people.
I agree that the asset market, I guess that cuts both ways though, right? Yeah. Like we're talking about a negative impact in asset markets that is nothing more than a zag to the zig of what they've done in asset markets. And that's the part that I struggle with, is how you can have the Fed intervene in some of these elements without creating that impact in asset markets. And then when we say, well, now there's a decline in housing or a decline in stock valuations, you know, isn't it true that it's a decline from an increase that they helped facilitate? You know, is a decline in the highest unaffordability in housing ever a bad thing? Is a decline in tech PE ratios that are 50, 70, and 100 times earnings, is that a bad thing? All of it to me, I'm not so much speaking to my divine right to pick a valuation. I'm more speaking to the fact that there's a distortion that we invite that we can't break free from once we enable this broader capacity for monetary policy.
Yeah, from a social perspective, I think you're completely right. I'd add that, you know, sort of that's pretty much what Jay Powell said at Jackson Hole, right? He basically told you, we're going to have to slow down the economy. We're going to have to affect asset markets negatively. We're going to have to raise unemployment because that's the only way to get inflation down. And he, you know, I'm finally, you know, sort of thinking that he's right about policy when he starts talking like that.
So you do believe that the Fed funds rate is a tool that right now that will be effective in bringing down inflation via its capacity for slowing down economic activity?
Yes, I think that there's very strong limits to the ability of the Fed to generate growth to the upside by lowering interest rates. It depends where it starts from. It depends what the context of the economy is. It depends where interest rates are, where they start. Bringing interest rates from a high level to a low level will stimulate the economy for sure. Bringing interest rates from a low level to a slightly lower level just distorts asset markets. It, you know, sort of has very limited ability to stimulate the economy. Diminishing returns, exactly. But bringing interest rates from a low level to a quite high level, right, is something that for sure, in my opinion, can bring on a recession, which is the only way to induce inflation. And in fact, you know, sort of our work here at Amberwave, you know, historically, if you look at the history of Fed tightening cycles, right, the median amount that the Fed tightens before inducing a recession is about 3.3%, right? Fed tightens 3.3%. That's the median size of the tightening cycle they get through before you have a recession. What's priced into the market in terms of the in the futures right now is about 3.7%. So it's in excess of that 3.3. But then it's also on top of that, very important to consider what the Fed is doing with its balance sheet operations. And when you look at the research about mapping the balance sheet operations, and by this I mean both the taper that happened earlier this year, don't forget the Fed was still buying bonds in March, the taper earlier this year, and also the quantitative tightening that's going to be going on, that's going on now and is about to step up in September, right? That's allowing the Fed allowing bonds to roll off its balance sheet as they mature, right? When you add those operation with those operations, I think you can add another 200 to 350 or so of tightening of Fed funds equivalent tightening from the balance sheet operations, right? So you add this all up, you get well in excess of 500, maybe as many as almost 700 basis points of absolute total tightening being delivered, again, versus a historical median of about 330 basis points. So they're very much well into the territory of inducing a recession based on the guidance in the futures market and the forwards market, as well as the quantitative tightening expectations that they're about to raise and keep going, you know, raise the amount of the ceiling of bonds that roll off and keep going.
So the argument you're making is that they can induce a recession via tightening mechanisms, and that they're in the process of doing so. And that argument follows a presupposition that the only way to contain inflation is to create a recession. So if one does not believe that all growth is inflationary, is it possible that sometimes a recession may invite more negative than the positive of containing inflation?
Are you asking whether a recession can make inflation move even higher?
No, we already know it can because it's done it in rare moments. I guess I'm wondering if it is true that the way to contain, and if you believe that inflation is too much money chasing too few goods and services, and that therefore inflation has to be fought on the demand side. So induction of a recession is a demand side solution, right?
Yeah.
Let's get a lot less people employed and help them to spend a lot less money to contain inflation, as opposed to a supply side solution via greater output, greater production.
And I see
and
what you're...
that is, I don't want to hide the ball. I mean, I'm here to hear your take, not my take, but that is my view. I don't believe a recession is generally needed to cure inflation. I think a strong currency and high incentive structure for output is generally a pretty consistent cure for inflation. But I'm wanting you to represent your viewpoint fairly. Your view would be that recession is needed to bring inflation down, and that the Fed is taking the policy tightening measures necessary to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I understand where you're going. So I would agree for sure that expanding the supply side can provide disinflationary pressure. And in fact, you know, we had similarly low unemployment rates in 2018, 2019, but we didn't have 8-9% inflation. And a significant reason of why is because of policies designed to expand the supply side that prevented inflation from materializing.
We had 8 or 9% inflation, but it was on the other side of the decimal. It was 1.8 or 1.9% inflation, right?
Exactly. So, you know, the Trump administration, you know, had an aggressive deregulatory agenda. Very good for the supply side. It had a tax reform agenda, in particular lowering business tax rates, very good, and personal tax rates, very good for the supply side. And it was working on various trade and industrial programs to generate production at home. So all of that stuff allowed the supply side to expand to meet rising demand, and we were able to have a very low unemployment rate without that inflation. So I 100% absolutely agree that supply side is where, you know, low expanding the supply side is where you want to be from a long-term inflation problem. The difference is that I think that supply side policies operate over the course of many years, right? They're not a short-term cyclical management policy. It would be very difficult and cumbersome to raise tax rates and lower tax rates, in an attempt to control inflation, right? Or to just keep lowering them indefinitely to the point where you have no revenue left, because every time inflation is higher, you just lower them and you never raise them. So the supply side is absolutely a tool for long-term price stability. And but it's not great for short-term management. And I would also argue that, you know, the Biden administration is very clearly, in my opinion, going the wrong way on the supply side.
Sure.
Right? They have an aggressive regulatory agenda. You look at their so-called Inflation Reduction Act. You know, I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago arguing that the Inflation Reduction Act's more likely to add to inflation than take away inflation. The reason being the supply side. It's going to make the supply side even worse. They're raising taxes on business. There's a whole host of of subsidies for the environment, which are distortionary of the supply side. Right. And, you know, sort of climate may be a serious problem, but there's no getting around the fact that it's distortionary on the supply side. And all of that is more likely to add to inflation than to reduce inflation. And then to make that even worse, this, you know, student debt forgiveness, which is, you know, which is news this week, you know, the size of the student debt forgiveness is about twice the deficit hole as is provided in the Inflation Reduction Act. So, you know, we're going the wrong direction on the supply side for sure.
So let's get into markets a little bit. You're back in the game. You're managing capital. When you look at the macro environment, what do you like right now? What do you think, both in terms of what you're describing and your outlook on the fiscal and monetary side of things and how it might impact investor decisions, but just at large, what do you think thematically is kind of the environment we're in right now?
Great. So I guess I'll start with, you know, sort of short to medium term, you know, sort of a view for a few months to a few quarters. And then we can zoom out from there if you like. You know, to start with, I'd emphasize what I said before, that the Fed has definitely, in my view, put us on track to have a recession. Now, that said, predicting when that recession occurs is always more of an art than a science. My analysis of historical data indicate to me that it's probably going to be around the turn of the year, maybe sometime in the first half of next year, right? So the overarching framework is that there is going to be a recession in the US, but not yet. And what that means is that we've been fading recessionary pricing over the course of the summer, that priced as though the recession were happening now, because we don't believe we're in a recession now. We believe that recession is coming in the future. And at the same time, on the upside, fading any pricing that looks like there's a recession never, right? And so that would be, you know, so in the combination of those implies that until we get a recession, we're very likely to have a pretty wide range on the S&P 500 and, you know, sort of trade in that range between the extremes of recession now and recession never until the economic data get to a point at which it looks like the recession is happening now. And things are a little bit more interesting than that, because the rally that we've had recently in stock markets and sort of the ease in interest rates that has occurred has loosened financial conditions, undermining the Fed's efforts to weaken the economy, which ultimately means that the Fed actually just has to tighten more. And there's a sense in which the higher the stock market goes now, the more it has to fall later, because the more the Fed has to tighten and crush growth.
And so when you think that way about the intersection of asset markets and what the Fed has to do and what it means to overall economy, how do you quantify it? Is it formulaic, or is there room for qualitative things changing the sort of econometric scale there? In other words, is there potential for earnings growth or a productivity boost that absorbs some of that? Or do you think there's an inherent relationship between the two that has to find equilibrium?
No, it works exactly the way you just described it. So the way my process works is to start with my expectations for growth and inflation, map those into nominal GDP growth, and then map those into a reasonable range for earnings. And so where does it look like earnings will be if we have a really bad outcome with inflation or real growth? And where does it look like earnings will be if we have better outcomes? And then what are the multiples that are most likely to be associated with those? And so when you do that, I wind up getting a range, you know, a range of reasonable outcomes that I think would be reasonable extremes to fade on the S&P until we get to a point where we're at the recession now.
And is there a bottom-up component to any of what you're doing, apart from top-down index outlook within markets? Let's take, you know, year-to-date, for example, and again, talking my book, at my firm, we happen to be very bottom-up and very agnostic about index outlook. But in theory, energy, of course, has done quite well this year, even in the midst of a pretty bad tape across the indexes. Is there a sector outlook that fits into what you're doing, let alone individual company?
Not into this strategy that we're talking about now, which is our macro strategies, which really are driven by top-down views on economics and policy and what that means for equity markets, what it means for interest rates, for different parts of the yield curve, what it means for inflation, what it means for currencies.
Got it. And so when you fast forward past this point of kind of recession waiting, essentially, there's ambiguity about when and how severe the current environment plays out. But I know we spent a little time together in New York and talking about this, but the idea, global macro at large over the last 15 years has had a very different, a very diminished opportunity set relative to the 10, 15 years before that. Do you think that on the other side of this particular moment where every day we're looking for language in a J-PAL presser to make a decision, do you think that macro is coming back and that there will be a better opportunity set for those trying to analyze event-driven realities in currency markets, in fixed income, in equities?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm so glad you asked that because we really do think that. And at the beginning of the call, I described ourselves as people who invest based on mega trends and long-term trends in asset markets. And we do think that those long-term mega trends are shaping up for a universe in which global macro is going to be a real star in future years. And the reason is that we're transitioning from a world in which policy was crushing volatility anywhere and everywhere it came up. We talked a lot about activist monetary policy and monetary policy trying to crush any small deviation in inflation, any small deviation in equity markets. And so anytime there was volatility in any corner of the asset markets, central banks crushed it. That's not a good environment for macro. That's a good environment for relative value strategies that take large amounts of leverage and need a low volatility environment. And it's a good environment for things that are basically leveraged beta, that are beta of one form or another. But looking forward, that's completely flipped on its head. And it's not just monetary policy that's creating volatility. It's not just fiscal policy that's creating volatility. It's microeconomic policy as well. Across the spectrum, its antitrust policy is ramping up in a bipartisan manner and going to prevent, you know, sort of tech giants from buying VC, you know, venture capital projects, which make it much more difficult to exit. It's trade policy and trade conflicts, again, totally bipartisan now in a way that it wasn't 4, 5, 10 years ago, to be activists on trade policy, enormous volatility contributors, very inflationary. It's going to be industrial policy. Again, bipartisan. It doesn't matter who's in control in Washington. Industrial policy is going to be inflationary, and it's going to be a volatility contributor. So all of these things are bipartisan. They're not going to be changing. They are the big trends that are going to be shaping global asset markets for the next 10 years. And the volatility that's driven both by monetary and fiscal policy, as well as the more microeconomic policies, is going to make macro a fabulous strategy, we think, for the next decade, because we're going to go from a world in which we saw, you know, one or two good macro pitches a year to a world like this one where there's, you know, 8-10 good macro pitches a year. And strategies that are reliant on leverage, strategies that are reliant on beta, we think are going to be in for a little bit of a tougher time.
And so it sounds like if you did hear my conversation with Judy Shelton, Judy and I are both really critical and concerned about the migration into financialization and excessive financialization that I believe has been a byproduct of excessive monetary accommodation. It sounds like you're optimistic. Like, to me, the notion of global macro coming back in fray is a very optimistic thing because, of course, individual managers can be wrong. They have to have the talent to analyze where things are in the world and what's going on. But I would prefer that there be an organic flow to what is taking place in the health of a currency, of a geography, more event-driven responses and markets to things, as opposed to leveraged beta, and as opposed to the mere mechanical financialization of things that I think puts downward pressure on growth from the lack of organic productivity that it incentivizes. Is what you're suggesting we're heading back into a bit a good sign for potentially kicking up some productivity that's been somewhat lagging for quite some time in the midst of financial repression?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly right. And if I could just paraphrase how I interpret what you just said, we're going to allow for some price discovery. Right. Yeah. Policy has been killing price discovery for 2 decades now, right? 25 years now, killing price discovery. And that's led to distortions across the supply side of the economy. And when we go into a world in which we're reshaping the economy because we're allowing price signals to allocate capital, right? That means volatility, and that means, potentially significant productivity leaps.
Well, I think that everything you're saying is exactly my view. And I wonder then what the challenge, if we switch what the challenge is out of price discovery and out of these realities that no longer get the easy buck from effective use of leverage, what would be some of the potential pitfalls?
So some of the potential pitfalls are that some of this is not just volatility because the monetary policy is sort of stepping off the gas a little bit. Some of it is volatility because of what we described before, like industrial policy, right? And, I'm a supporter of industrial policy for very particular causes like defense technology and critical technologies like semiconductors and things that we just can't allow ourselves to be at the mercy of China producing, because you wake up tomorrow and you find it's a big national security concern that China's cut off supply of a key element, right, or a key ingredient in the supply chain, right? So I'm a big believer in industrial policy for national security reasons and also as a driver of technology growth. But it is true that industrial policy always entails some inefficiency. Right. Yes, we got the internet because of defense driven industrial policy. We got radar because of defense driven industrial policy. But just like with PPP, you had to go through lots of dead end bad projects to get the good ones. Right. And so while this stuff, I believe, on the whole is all very beneficial to the economy, in the long run, there is no getting around the fact that there is going to be some waste between here and there.
Well, we covered a lot of ground. Tell listeners how they can follow up with you, learn more about what you're doing and where you're writing and what you're kind of devoting your efforts to. Where can you be found as people want to hear more about all this?
Sure. So you can hop over to our website, amberwavepartners.com. You can contact us through the website. We'd be very happy to chat with you. There's an insights tab and a media and in the news tab on the website where you can follow all of our writing, all of our media appearances.
Thanks so much for joining us. Thank you for your extremely useful analysis. I would love to have you back on, Steve. I think that we've covered a lot of ground, but I think there's a lot more we could cover. And I've learned a lot, and I'm sure listeners have as well.
Yeah, this is great, David. Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure to be here.
Thanks again. Well, I hope you enjoyed our guest today. I hope you found that conversation provocative. I think it's deeper end of the pool stuff. I think a lot of listeners of Capital Record like that. There's obviously a diverse type of guest that we have on the podcast, but I really enjoy guests like this. Thoughtful, there were certain things I don't fully agree with, but there was, as you heard throughout our conversation, a lot of common ground, and even where there's discussion about where some of the limiting principles, let's say, of countercyclical interventions ought to be, things like that, there's still a common ground as to the trade-offs that exist, as to what the costs could be, the risks, and how we want to think about some of it. There's more thoughts in there as to the assessment of inflation and what the monetary role would be. I think you guys are aware of some of the views If you listen to my recent podcast with John Tamney, with Judy Shelton, there's certain areas of the current inflationary moment that I have some contrary views on. But overall, I just have to say I found Stephen's insights provocative and thoughtful, and I hope that you found it insightful. When we think about global macro and the changing of the guard in many aspects of capital markets as we hopefully get out of this period of financial repression we've been living in. So I look forward to your feedback. I look forward to you sharing this podcast far and wide. And of course, look forward to coming back to you next week with another guest and another conversation on National Review's Capital Record. Thank you so much for listening.